Hello and welcome to the Rare Disease Podcast for Medics. I'm Lucy Mackay and I'm the CEO at Medics for Rare Diseases. We're equipping medical professionals to reduce the diagnostic odyssey and improve the patient experience for those living with rare conditions. This podcast will feature interviews with patients, clinicians, advocates, students, and researchers focusing on rare disease and clinical medicine from all walks of life. So sit back, relax, and if you like what you hear, follow us to keep up to date with our latest episodes. Thanks, everyone, and remember to dare to think rare. Welcome back, everyone, to a new season of the Rare Disease Podcast for Medics. And it's a new year, and we're really glad to be back on your podcast station. So here is Lucy Mackay. I'm the CEO of Medics for Rare Diseases, if you've never tuned in before. And today I'm really excited to bring a very special guest to the podcast, the Baroness Nicola Blackwood. Nicola is a leader in science and entrepreneurship. She is a member of the House of Lords and chair of Genomics England and Oxford University Innovation. She is also a board member of the biotechnology company BioNTech. Nicola served as Minister for Innovation in the Department of Health and Social Care under two prime ministers, where she led on life sciences, NHS data and digital transformation, and global health security. She was the first female MP for Oxford and was elected by MPs of all parties to chair the Commons Science and Tech Committee. She remains one of the youngest committee chairs in British history and the only woman to have chaired the Commons Science and Tech Committee. So you can see why she's a very special guest. But for me, this is particularly important because the first time that I came to know about Nicola really was at the British Paediatric Surveillance Unit Tea Party in 2019. And this is a tea party that has been hosted for a number of years and we always love going to. And this is where I saw the Baroness Nicola Blackwood presenting this new idea or this new call for evidence, I guess, about rare disease. She was starting the big conversation about rare disease and how it impacts people in the UK. And that's really where I got involved. And it's been really fun to see what has developed since then, most notably the UK Rare Diseases Framework. So having witnessed that piece of history, I'm really glad to be here with Nicola. Thank you for joining me, Nicola.
Hi, Lucy.
So you were the first peer that I've ever met or that I've ever really worked with before. And so I know we're here to talk about all things rare disease usually, but I'd be really interested. I think our audience would be really interested to know how you got into politics.
Well, it's a slightly strange story. So I started off at a very, very young age being completely fixated on music. I trained at music college from the age of 14. And was dedicated as a young and romantic child to a career in music. But I grew up in a medical house. So my dad was a cardiologist. My mum was a theatre nurse until I was born. And I had three siblings. So she had her hands full with us. Although she did help my dad with his clinics quite a lot. And so I grew up in this medical household. I saw my dad saving lives. When I was born, they were working at Barrabwana Hospital in Soweto. And actually, he got in quite a lot of trouble because he organized a national rheumatic fever conference for the day for my due date. And he was just very lucky that I'm a very impatient person. And so I was born 2 weeks before my due date. And so at 2 weeks old, I went to my first medical conference. But, you know, I had this sort of crisis of conscience at the age of 24 when I was on my second music degree. And I felt as though I wasn't really contributing to improving the world, to giving back in the way that I had observed from my parents. And so I went to try and find out what that might look like. And I did all sorts of internships and volunteering and all sorts of things. And one of the things that I did was I volunteered at Conservative Campaign Headquarters. And while I was there, I thought, maybe this is something that I could do. Maybe this is the way that I could do it. And I ran away as quickly as I could, went back to do my DPhil in music. And while I was doing that, the Oxford seat came up. And gradually I sort of thought, well, maybe I should apply for this. And I did apply. And 3 weeks later, I was the candidate. 4 years later, I was the MP. And I never regret a moment of that. But it was not a planned route to power in politics. It was the example of my parents that I needed to contribute, and the feeling that maybe this was a way in which I could try and give service. And there's lots of frustrations in politics, and there's lots of feelings as though you never really shift the dial. But in the end, looking back, I think there are times at which I have been able to help people and have been able to, you know, raise issues like rare diseases and other issues which make it worth all of the times when you felt as though you were shouting into the void.
Wow, I didn't know that. What a pivot. I mean, if you think about the introductory paragraph of, you know, science and tech, I would never have guessed that based on every time I've heard you speak. So there you go. Like, who says you have to be arts or science?
One of my earliest memories is of my dad sitting me on his lap with a very early edition of Harvey's The Circulation and explaining to me how the circulation works and how this had influenced cardiology and medicine and how we wouldn't have, you know, the kind of medical training we have. So I was quite informally well-trained. As hard as I tried, I think I didn't really have much of a chance other than to end up in the field that I'm in now, even if it's been a slightly unorthodox route.
I think I have a similar thing. You try, you think you're not going to go down a similar route, and then it turns out you will. But also, as a Barts girl, we all love Harvey over there. So I'd also say that something that has been really good for me working in this field is, I think, until I really got involved with the big conversation and the Department of Health and everything that was going around in 2019 with the what would then be the framework, is I now have a much better understanding of not all politicians are the same. You know, there's different, and there's different stories, and how you, like you're saying there, you weren't planning on this career, but you took that opportunity, and then you just try and shift the dial.
Yeah, and I think because it was quite unexpectedly won the seat. I wasn't supposed to win in Oxford West and Abingdon, and it was a big shock to me. It was a big shock to everybody else at the time. And so I was determined to make sure that I did a good job, firstly. I'm a big product of a girls' school, and so I'm a perfectionist. So I always like to do everything well. And so my immediate response was to make sure that I sought out people who knew what they were doing. And, you know, my seat, Oxford West and Abingdon, was full of academics, scientists, clinicians, you know, brilliant people who influence thought and change and innovation globally, not just nationally. And so I was incredibly lucky. You know, I always say that I was an MP who would get footnoted letters. I was the only one, really. And so I couldn't be a kind of lazy MP. I had to think about what I did. And it was hugely challenging for somebody with the training that I'd had to think about, you know, pensions policy and finance policy and health policy and science policy and all of these different areas to the depth that was expected. So I was challenged. It was in my first term, it was the equivalent of doing, you know, not just a master's level degree, but a sort of PhD level degree in politics and economics and all these things. And I don't think I could have done anything else but landed on the sciences and healthcare as an area of specialization, because it was so strong locally, but also there was such a lack of representation at that time in Westminster, and a huge lack of representation in areas like rare diseases, where the topics were even spoken about back in 2010, 11, 12, and issues like the need for increasing investment in research and development hadn't even got up to mainstream policy. So all of those areas were just starting to be spoken about. So that is sort of my hinterland, as it were.
Amazing, amazing. So what does your job entail? What does it do on a day-to-day?
Well, so now I'm a member of the House of Lords, so I will vote on laws. I will try and understand the legislation which is going through the House of Lords. I will speak in questions, so scrutinize
the different departments. So that may be asking questions of the Department of Health. So I asked a question on migraine, for example, recently, which is an area which we know is sort of quite poorly resourced and poorly understood. And then I chair Genomics England, which, as a lot of your listeners will know, provides whole genome sequencing services now as a standard of care for rare disease and cancer patients. But we also are funded to do new frontier research programs like the Generation Study in testing new cancer genomic technologies. We call it Cancer 2.0, and in working out how we diversify the data set, because a lot of those who've been sequenced are very European heritage. And then I'm on a couple of other boards, as you mentioned. So my day-to-day is trying to juggle all of those things, and it's very fluctuating. So I'll spend a lot of time on the phone, on emails, on Zoom calls and in person, sometimes in the House of Lords, sometimes in Oxfordshire. And I'm very lucky I still get to hang around with those brilliant scientists, not just from the UK, but globally, trying to understand the technologies. But mostly I just sit at the intersection between the public sector, whether it's the NHS or other parts of public sector, innovation, the innovators, the scientists, some of them in the private sector and researchers, and government or funders, and trying to make sure that those barriers that sometimes come up of language and understanding don't get lost. So trying to make things happen between those three groups for the benefit usually of patients now. So that's what I do for Genomics England and for others, because I think what I learned when I was on the Science and Technology Committee was I was really nervous because I wasn't a scientist. When I became the chair of the Science and Technology Select Committee in the Commons, I thought, everyone's going to hate me. I'm not a scientist. And then when I became the chair, so many scientists contacted me, and they were just not interested in the fact whether I was a scientist or they wasn't a scientist. They wanted to educate me in what the issues were and make sure that they had a voice in the Commons and that I did a good job. And they wanted to help me do a good job. And I realized the only thing that mattered was informing myself, learning, being humble about what I didn't know, asking the right questions, and then working out how I could learn to be a good translator of science into politics and back again. And so if I've tried to learn anything, it's that.
I love that. I see that now, like having watched how this system works a little bit more closely through our involvement, through Medics for Rare Diseases involvement within policy. But also that's really what we ask from our doctors on the front line. So not specialist doctors in a tertiary center, but our audience. We're just asking you to be a translator, really. You don't need to be the top expert who's prescribing the very expensive drug, but you need to help patient get to wherever they need to be or have the information that they need. And you're facilitating that, and you're a kind of not an expert, but you know the system and you know where to go and you know what someone's needs might be, and you're well informed and back again, because you know the person in a tertiary center isn't going to be able to do the primary care stuff. They're doing their specific job. They also need a translator back again, which is why I believe wholeheartedly that primary care has to be that linchpin in rare disease for that translation purposes. I love that. So you were sort of getting into tech anyway, but then this isn't just a career thing, as you've already mentioned. You clearly have this advocacy desire, which is commendable, but also it then became a bit more personal, didn't it?
Yeah, so I always say I've got a slightly unusual perspective on health and sort of science tech policy, because it's a bit 360, because obviously I grew up in the NHS with my dad. I became the health and life science minister, but also, as you know, I have a rare disease, I have early Stan loss. And it took 30 years for me to be diagnosed. I wasn't diagnosed till 2013 when I was an MP. And that was by accident by a neurologist I was referred to. And he diagnosed me in 20 minutes after 30 years. And I started, I suppose, the first indication I had any kind of unusual illness was when I was seven, when I started with nighttime asthma. But that wouldn't be any kind of warning flag, because my I was aspirin's family, and you know, we just all thought it was usual. And then I got, you know, various different illnesses, plus torticollis when I was seven. When I was 12, I was in and out of hospital with various different things, and I got really serious migraines from the age of 16, and the accumulation of illnesses made me feel like I was a hypochondriac. And at a certain point, when I was 17, it got so serious I had to come out of school and couldn't do GCSE and A-levels properly. I got very, you know, really poor results. It was a miracle I got into university at all. I was told that I wouldn't be able to go to university or ever have a job, which is a very depressing thing to tell a teenager. And I believed it. Like, I mean, I didn't think I had a sort of future really at that time. But I was very lucky because obviously I had medical parents, and so they were being sort of suggested all sorts of slightly fringe neurological medications. And my parents said, actually, no, we'll just let her rest and sort of gradually try sort of a little bit of exercise here and there. And, you know, I'm obviously know that I'm very lucky and I have quite a simple form of EDS compared to others who have more complex forms. So I gradually improved and I managed to get into Oxford academically. And when I started, I was still quite sick, but I just about coped. In hospital again in my second year, on missed a term. Doing my degree, doing the exams was extremely difficult. But anyway, I got through it. But it was always limping along, and it was always with peaks and troughs, which I think is what happens with fluctuating illnesses. But I learned this lesson from people's reactions and from, actually, to be honest, from clinicians' reactions a lot of the time, which is that I had to hide a lot of it and always seem like I was coping, seem like I wasn't overwhelmed, never look like I was overly distressed, because then I would get labeled as being just anxious or having a mental health problem, and not look like I had too many problems, because then I might just be a hypochondriac. And so I would always just present part of the problem, because I was trying to manage the reactions of those around me. And if when I was at university or I was at work, I would completely try and hide that I was sick at all. So often I would just disappear when I was sick, because I didn't want to look weak, because I'd learned that having illness in the workplace or at university just labels me as being a weak link. And that wasn't tolerated really. And so I had this sort of very double life all the way up until I started getting very ill, which was in about 2015, 16. And I don't really know what triggered it, but I started fainting every day, because I couldn't stand up long enough. I couldn't safely take the tube. I couldn't safely walk across the road. I fainted in the middle of roads. I stopped traffic. I mean, it was quite a drama. And at that point, I ended up fainting in front of the statistical editor of The Sun, at which point the secret was out. And I had to do a news story in The Sun about the fact that I had been diagnosed with Ehlers Danlos and all the consequential treatments that I was having and so on. And I hadn't really fully understood, because it was 18 months after my diagnosis. I didn't understand really, hadn't really got on top of the treatment regime. It was sort of mostly working, but not completely. And I didn't know how it would affect the general election that I was going into and how people would react. And so the effect of that for me was very stressful, but it also felt like an enormous relief, because instead of having two lives, I had one, which is that I wasn't trying to pretend that I was fine all the time and then going away and hiding and being sick. And so that was an interesting part of my life. And it was a bit disappointing in the election, because there was a proportion of the campaign in that election where people knocked on doors and said that I had early dementia, that I had fatal MS, that I wasn't going to be fit for being a member of parliament because I had this degenerative illness and so on. And so that was quite difficult to cope with and to sort of keep my cool with. Actually, I managed to get a sort of significantly increased majority at that election, so it didn't affect the outcome of the election, but it was quite I found that quite shocking. And it indicates quite how ill understood rare disease is in terms of how it affects someone's ability to perform in the workplace, and how on one level I had been wrong to hide away that I was ill, but on the other hand, it had been justified, to a point in public, and maybe in public life, it does affect how people respond to you. And so after that, I sort of carried on and did my job and had the opportunity to speak out more about issues which felt like I had been able to give back to so many people who had taken care of me, clinicians and the NHS. And, it was important to me to have that. And then, of course, I lost my seat in 2017. Actually, it wasn't until then that I was able to concentrate on my health. And I really recovered a lot then. And my health now is in a much more stable place. But that was a very strange journey through diagnosis and public life.
Parallel to each other then, basically.
Well, I think it was at the beginning of EDS really being sort of as understood as it is now. Because if you think back to 2013, and so I was referred, I was diagnosed, by Professor Rodney Graham and, his clinics. And so there was, I had good support, but it wasn't the issue. The diagnosis wasn't the issue. The issue was integrating, getting the right medication regime, working out the elements which were EDS. So, I have autonomic disorder, and getting into autonomic unit, working out what the right medication is, because that's quite difficult to titrate, and getting GPs to know how to manage that and understand that. The same with, migraine treatment. And of course, you've got different clinicians for all of those things. And it was really hard for me to get to the appointments because I had to be in Parliament. This is the same for anybody who works. But, this is just the reality of trying to work and live with a rare condition and going through that process, because diagnosis isn't a day. Diagnosis is the day that you get diagnosed, and then you go through, okay, so how do we then work out what the longer term consequences of that are and how you manage it? And that probably took me about 3 years to get from the day of diagnosis to, okay, this is daily what this means for me. And then it's taken a little bit longer to work out how to live with that on a day-to-day basis and be preventatively managing my life. And I sort of, touch wood, managed. I think I'm pretty good at that now. But it is a learning curve. And to a certain extent, you have to have the space in your life to be able to do that. And you have to make sort of lifestyle decisions about how much space you're going to give yourself to prioritize your health. And how much you want to prioritize doing other things in your life that you're not going to give away, and you're going to take the health hit for doing it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think this is something that we talk about quite a lot about. It's like it's having a label, isn't it? And you can't have two labels at the same time. It can't be that you are a working politician and you've got a chronic condition. Society isn't very good at fitting people into both of those boxes. And you can see that in people's thinking. If the fact that someone could even campaign against you based on you having a chronic condition just demonstrates how people can't hold multiple identities in one go often for other people. But everyone has multiple identities. Everyone has lots of different things going on in their lives, and they show a bit in one arena and a show more in another arena. But to have you tell this story, which is obviously personal to you, but is so quintessentially the rare disease story, as you know.
Yes. I'm not unique. I mean, my story is an easy story compared to many parents with children who are much sicker than I am. And I'm very aware of that. So I don't really talk about it. But, I think that it's very hard. What's the most notable thing to me, how hard it is to communicate to people who are well, what's going on when you're not well, because it's so alien.
Yeah. And that it isn't, there is, and I try to always say, there is no better or worse situation. It's your situation. But also the fact that, you know, you've had parents who were medical, you had possibly, you know, you had people around you who could support you. You know, you were living in a country where you speak the language, you've got an education. There's all these things on your side, potentially, when it comes to being believed and having your symptoms taken seriously and getting a diagnosis. And yet, even for you, that's something that's hard. And even now with the diagnosis and even within your position, you still feel the impacts that everyone out there is talking about with living with a rare condition.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, we talk a lot about, I think, compassion fatigue with a rare condition or a chronic condition. And I think examples would be, you know, when I was having that period when it was very difficult for me to get, you know, my medication titrated, when I was struggling to get control of my blood pressure and heart rate. So I was just, you know, conking out all the time. Like, there wasn't anything serious wrong. It was just, I couldn't keep standing up all the time. And that was something I wasn't going to have a heart attack or a stroke or anything. I just couldn't like keep upright. And I didn't want to not go to work because I was well enough mentally to work. It was just a standing up problem. And this was really challenging for my work colleague. And at one point I was told to go home for 3 weeks and get better. And it was, I was told I couldn't come back.
Yeah.
And
you've got the one or the other.
Yeah. It was because I was being disruptive at work, essentially, by changing. And, you know, it happens again. You probably remember when I fainted. There's a video of me fainting in Parliament, which was really unfortunate. And I should have known that I shouldn't have gone in to speak when I knew that I wasn't feeling great. But I went in, I spoke, and I fainted at the dispatch box. And they told me not to come back for a week until I was okay. And I didn't need to not come back for a week because once I fainted, I was fine. Because it's the assumption is that if something like that is happening, you must be so ill that you need a week off or something like that. And there is the sort of not listening to the voice of the patient or the, you know, the person with the condition, that it persists. And a lot of workplaces are like this. Some are getting better. But for patients with fluctuating illness, invisible illness, chronic illness, we have a long way to go. And I think that's why you are doing Medics for Rare Disease is so important, because you can help equip clinicians and equip patients to advocate for themselves. And the more we do that, the more awareness will grow and the better we'll all get at learning how to manage this.
You're listening to the Rare Disease Podcast for Medics, brought to you by Medics for Rare Diseases. If you like what you've heard so far, stay connected with us by clicking the follow button and stay updated on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We love to hear from our rare disease community, and we welcome you to join us as a rare disease ally. Just hit the links in the episode description. Yeah, I thank you so much. And yeah, sometimes I've joked with this about what, you know, when you think about public affairs and what's our strategy, sometimes when I'm looking at, say, parliamentary questions or things that are happening in the House of Parliament, I think I really just need to go in there and do a rare disease 101 session so that we all can all get on the same page, because I feel like there's so much parliamentary time wasted because everyone's taking one condition at a time and asking one specific question. And if I could just go in and be like, right, everyone, sit down. We're going to do a rare disease 101 session. We've got someone with lived experience, come in, Nicola. There's such a basic lack of just core understanding. And, you know, it's a bit like years and years ago when cancer was the big C and people didn't talk about cancer. And so therefore, people would have had to be individually educated over and over again. Now, I can't imagine that you could walk into Parliament and find someone who couldn't give you a top line summary of what cancer is or what someone with cancer might be challenged by. And that should really be the same for rare conditions and chronic conditions. But I think what you get at there is everyone people see, unless it's something like cancer, which we now have a better grasp on, people see illness and think acute. And so therefore you must be off for 2 weeks and then you'll come back and be better. And how frustrating that is, because actually that's your job and you want to be there and you don't want to be told what to do.
Well, also you feel the pressure to be better.
And you really won't. Yes, of course.
Come back in 2 weeks. I'm just going to faint again.
Everybody is trying to be helpful. It's just sort of lack of understanding. And as you say, there's also a perception that there is a huge difference between all rare conditions and chronic conditions. And actually, there is quite a lot of commonality, which you could have as a baseline. So you're right. Let's get the 101 out there and help everybody out.
Amazing. So now we're up to about 2017, I'm guessing, but it's 2018 or 2019 when you were in NHS Digital and Innovation. Is that right? When you started the big conversation?
Yeah. So they asked me to go back in. So I when I lost my seat, I had a brief period. I called it out in the wild, doing things in the real world. And I chaired the Human Tissue Authority. I did some work with Campaign for Science Engineering and a few sort of other advisory roles. And then Lord O'Shaughnessy, who was the Life Sciences Minister, had to step down sort of quite suddenly. And so they asked me to go into the House of Lords as the Life Sciences Minister. And that's when I did more or less the same life sciences job that I'd done before, although then in the Commons, I'd done mental health and public health as well. And this was very much the whole life sciences portfolio with, I was responsible for MHRA, NHS Digital, NICE. And that was a great job at a really good time. We were doing well then in clinical research and trials. And the aim then was to make the UK, you know, a great test bed for the world in research and in clinical research and innovations. We have such a great depth of expertise in the UK. And, you know, I lasted until about, you know, February 2020, and then I stood down.
So what was the, because I sort of tried to describe it at the beginning, but what was the premise of the big conversation? What was your aim?
So we needed to renew the rare disease strategy, and the initial proposal was to do consultation with a few parties. And I suppose because of my own background, was quite uncomfortable with this because the rare disease community is very diverse and it does have some great advocates from the charities. But even then, the charitable sector is very diverse. So I was really concerned that if we did a consultation, we wouldn't really get a representative response from the community, and then whatever we produced would be fine but would leave behind some rare disease members of the community and wouldn't have true buy-in. There wouldn't be a sense of ownership. And I had this sort of slightly searching conversation with my civil servants who said, I want to do a survey. And what I meant by this was, like, you know, the normal online surveys, you can get many of them. I'm not going to name a survey and technology, but I didn't think it was that complicated. But this had apparently never been done in government before. And so it caused great consternation amongst the civil service at the time. And they said, but we'll get loads of responses. And I said, well, that's the purpose of it. You have to get loads of responses and then analyze it. And they said, but what if they all say something different? And I said, I don't think they're going to. I think we'll find that some key themes will emerge. And they were really worried about it. And there was a lot of consternation and it kind of bounced back and forth up and down the different groups within civil service. And they were just like, I don't think we can do this, Minister. It's very courageous, as Sir Humphrey would say, and yes, Minister. And eventually I just said, no, I want to do it. We're going to do it. And so they put out the survey with great trepidation, and we got 6,000 responses, I think, within something like 5 days. And what was really impressive, I think, was the consistency of the responses. And we on purpose didn't just go for the tick box exercise where you could just tick within certain pre-prepared answers, multiple choice. We also allowed natural language responses, qualitative responses. And so even within the qualitative responses and the multiple choice, there was a consistency of what the concerns were: coordination of care, accessibility of treatment, availability of specialists. We all know what the challenges are in the rare disease community. It wasn't a surprise to me that there was consistency of the responses that could then build the framework with the credibility and the authority of it coming from a large proportion and a cross-section of rare disease patients, advocates, clinicians, and the workforce. And so that really encouraged me that when we did design the framework, it would A, have buy-in, and B, be properly representative. And I really think that that tool, that method of designing policy should be used more often, because it does work and it is properly reflective of what's going on in, you know, specialist areas. I don't think you can use it for all areas of policy, but something like rare diseases, it's, I think, important to know that you are targeting, you know, it's the right things. And so it was a success.
I mean, as a scientific method, it is a good idea to do larger sampling than the places you're already normally going. So I'm glad that you did choose to go wider, but it did feel different. It felt genuine and authentic, is what I would say. The launch of the big conversation and having people spend a lot of time. It was the first time we at Medics for Rare Diseases had really got had been given a chance to talk about the problems that we saw that were happening that were leading to the challenges. So not just what the challenges are, but we had some insight into why those challenges occur. And that's always been quite frustrating to not have, be able to say, to sort of have the platform to, at this point, weren't as familiar to people to be able to say, we actually know why some of these challenges are coming about and we need to think in another direction. And I think it was through the big conversation that then we were actually consulted and we had long conversations, and it was really the opening up for Medics for Rare Diseases. So I think it did. I think it was new for me, but in particular, but I also think there was that buy-in. I realize now, I don't know whether you were even involved in writing up the framework, were you? Because of the pandemic.
I think beforehand, yeah. It was prepared, but it wasn't finalized. There was a draft, but it wasn't finalized before I left.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I rang up the Department of Health Rare Diseases office in, I think, March 2020 and said, I know you've got other things going on, but just checking. Is this strategy? Because then it had been called a strategy before. What's going to happen with it? And as a group of us then got together a lot of stakeholders across rare disease to look at how COVID was impacting the rare disease ecosystem. And we came up with three areas. One was diagnostic delay, one was coordination of care, and one was access to treatment and clinical trials. And lo and behold, when the framework then came out in 2021, those were three of four priorities. So like you say, it's not necessarily that it was going to be news, but at least you had the evidence and at least you had brought everyone in. And I think, I don't know how much you've been able to be involved since, but I can certainly say from the community side that there is that buy-in. How people feel about what's happened since, I know less about, but certainly everyone within this field is aware of the policy. And I think that's just a great step forward, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think the challenge with, you know, a fragmented, some policy group, you know, areas, there's quite a consolidated and established kind of representative groups. And so it's very easy to go out and say, okay, we're thinking of changing this area, what do you think? And it's quite simple and straightforward. But, you know, I mean, there are obvious reasons why rare diseases is much more fragmented and difficult to access at a superficial level. But actually, in an age of technology, that's easily soluble, as we did in the big conversation. And we can keep doing that as the policy implementation goes through, with checking back to people, engaging with, you know, because I mean, one, I think, commonality with those with rare diseases and conditions is that they tend to be sort of quite active online. They're engaged in communities and so on. And so if you just put a little bit of effort in, you can reach into those communities and get some feedback. And so I think that government is moving more in that direction and becoming more, you know, technically literate. And I would like to see more of a sort of feedback loop, not just in the development of policy, but also the implementation of policy, so that you can course correct when things aren't quite playing out in the way that you think they should, or just when conditions change. I mean, we are in a very different world now than we were in 2019 when this was envisaged for all sorts of reasons. And so, you know, we should have dynamic policy development and implementation. I think this is probably a hangover from my, you know, select committee days, when I knew that I wasn't the expert in the room. And so I depended on the people who were the experts to make sure that I didn't make a fool of myself. And it's the same with this. You know, rare diseases are so complex and heterogeneous. There is no way that you can guarantee that you're doing the right thing without reaching out, you know, multiple directions many times over to make sure that you're moving in the right direction and that you're not making a mistake that could be potentially life-altering to people. And I think it is difficult, but not overwhelmingly difficult, to develop policy and, you know, care pathway solutions to keep that, you know, development and check-in process working, so that you can know if you're getting it right.
I like what you say there about course correct, because that's what we're asking of clinicians, is it's not to make people feel bad. We're not there to berate or anything, but it's a case of, look, you know, we know that this is how rare disease has been typically educated about. We know that there are these stigmas and biases within medicine that have a negative impact on people with rare conditions. But all we're asking now is a course correct. And also, you know, when you're working with someone who has a rare condition, you're very unlikely to have all the answers, but you can do sensible things and you can do basic things. You can put people in contact. You can ask someone who knows more. You can do a little research yourself. You can be courteous in how you speak to them and think about their basic needs, like prescriptions and mental health support and peer prescribing, peer support. And then if that's not quite right, just course correct. But I think in medicine, we've got to a point where we're so used to, these are the guidelines, this is the pro forma, this is what you do, that it's asking people to do something quite unfamiliar now. There isn't my patient has come in with this and therefore I follow this path in every rare disease. Well, what I'd like to get to is, again, with that cancer example, that you might not be able to do it for the specific disease, just like every cancer gets more as we understand more about it. But you can do a basic, you can have cancer care and you can have rare disease care. And that's all we're asking. And then you try things out and course correct. And really, that's just personalized medicine. And I find it quite funny, in a world of where we talk about personalized medicine, and yet we find it so difficult, or medical education or classic medical services find it so difficult, to incorporate people living with rare conditions. Because if you can't do it for people with rare conditions, how can we really get to somewhere where personalized medicine is a true thing? So that's ultimately what we're going for. So yeah, I think that feedback loop is really important, but also that it's not a blame thing. You're just trying to do it a bit better.
Yeah. And I would think of it as a feedback loop of sort of expertise and support, you know, yeah. Because, you know, we're at the beginning of learning about many, many rare conditions and understanding how to implement the right care. I mean, as I said, like, it took 3 years to find a good a good balance for my treatment. And I'm a relatively simple case. And so, you know, there is a great deal of complexity and there are experts in treatment and therapeutics, but that, you know, they are, you can't expect to be the expert in all of it. And so the only way that you can manage to deal with that heterogeneity is through networked intelligence, really. And you can get some of that digitally, but in reality, you need to get feedback from patients and you need to get feedback from clinicians and you need to get, you know, that combination. And I think we all just need to have a bit of humility in the face of that amount of complexity.
Yeah. I think if people can, I hope with like clinicians and things, if they can throw off this idea of that doctors know or are meant to know, then it can almost be a bit exciting. I think there's some frisson there of being able to maybe try something a bit different and learn something new in a way that there's less of that available sometimes these days, in particularly working in the NHS. Last February, we ran our first Rare Disease Day campaign and we sent out socks to people that we knew, influencers. We sent out a pair of stripy socks to you and stuck it in a bright red envelope in the hope that it would definitely get picked up. So thank you so much for taking part in that Show Your Stripes campaign. And I know you got your colleague along to do it as well in the House of Lords. Why did you put on your socks? Why was it important to you?
Well, I mean, we discussed, you know, my journey, and I was very naughty taking a picture it was Lord Narayan Patel, actually. He's a clinician himself and a great advocate of, you know, rare disease awareness and Genomics England and the work that we do there to try and improve diagnosis. And so he actually was one of the peers who came to pick me up off the floor when I fainted. And it was quite a funny one, because it was him who, he's an obs and gynae clinician. And then there was a gastric surgeon and a palliative care clinician who all came to try and help me when I fainted. And I thought, you know what, I don't think any of you can help me. I've been probably fine. But anyway, to get back to the point, I asked him to join me because he is a tremendous advocate of awareness. And for me, obviously, I feel as though we've come a really long way in terms of rare disease awareness, in terms of the Department of Health and NHS England. And this is becoming much more of a priority in terms of policy making. But I do think we still have much further to go in terms of availability, of access to specialists, of care pathways and awareness in primary care, and also in employment, of how to manage and engage with those with rare conditions. And so any awareness and expertise and networked, you know, information that we can bring to those who are supporting a family member, an employee, or a patient with a rare condition, I think is absolutely critical at this time, because we're just at a turning point when we could really improve the availability of care and support for those with rare diseases. And Show Your Stripes is a really important part of that.
Oh, well, thank you. And having people like yourself back it is incredibly valuable. And so we're really pleased to get those photos. So thank you so much for your time today. It's been such a great conversation, and especially after we've worked across Zoom for a number of years, but I don't think I've ever had much time to do a one-on-one. So thank you. But to finish off, I don't know, you've just summed up a really nice message about rare disease, but is there anything you would like to say, or anything that you'd like our clinical audience to take away, or anything you hope for the future for rare disease that you want to mention?
Well, I think, you know, having a rare disease can be really lonely, and you can feel as if other people don't understand, and your clinician doesn't understand, and your peers don't understand, and it can be exceptionally difficult to communicate what you're going through, and you can often feel as though you have to hide. I felt like that for a really long time. And I just think you should be confident that people understand, and they're more willing to listen, and they're more willing to go the extra mile than you think. I've found, you know, clinicians who I didn't expect made an enormous effort to try and take me, you know, to the next level of health. And they have been more willing to try and learn and understand and kind of cross-connect my care And it's not been an easy journey. Of course it hasn't, because it's difficult, and it's difficult because it is difficult. But I think it becomes less lonely when you actually talk openly and you tell people what's going on, and you take that risk of talking to people about.
Thank you, Nicola. That's such a great message. And as you know, we've started a rare disease discs, and I asked you at the top of the podcast if you had one. So what's your choice of song to go on our rare disease discs playlist?
My choice is Fleetwood Mac's Go Your Own Way, because I think that no one can tell you how to be a rare disease patient. No one can tell you how you should live. I'm not the blueprint patient by any means. I've made so many mistakes and embarrassed myself so many times. So, you know, just do it your own way and don't let anybody tell you that you should be doing a different care pathway or doing a different exercise regime or doing something different. Just, you know, learn what works for you and have confidence in that.
Yeah. Well, we love imperfect role models here. And I think you're a great imperfect role model. Do it your own way, get things wrong, get things right. But I think that authenticity and going forward and regardless is so good. So again, thank you so much for your time, Nicola. And I hope that everyone enjoyed this podcast, and we'll see you next week with the next episode. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the podcast. If you are interested in taking our free Rare Disease 101 module, full of useful tips for medical professionals, or perhaps joining one of our forums, visit the link in the episode description. To be notified of our weekly episodes, make sure you click the follow button to stay in the loop, or give us a follow on social media via the links provided. It means more than you know. Thanks everyone, and remember to dare to think rare. Medics for Rare Diseases is a charity registered in England and Wales. I'd like to take this opportunity to support our partners. The charity is supported by a number of commercial companies, including pharmaceutical companies, but is operated independently, and these companies have no editorial control over its contents. To find out more, please visit m4rd.org/sponsors.